Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Are those really the fingerprints of one of America's too-big-to-fail banks on yet another looming financial implosion? And if those reports are true, that Goldman Sachs has been helping the government of Greece, shall we say, paper over its debts, Eurozone finance ministers were asking today why they should be on the hook for yet another big bailout. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the New Harvard Business Review, a source of smart thinking for today's business world. The revival of smart begins at hbr.org. And by Microsoft, offering cloud computing for businesses with solutions for managing the transition to the cloud while managing costs for customers at microsoft.com/cloud services.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal on this President's Monday, February 15th. Just as European finance ministers were meeting on a financial bailout for Greece, an embarrassing new question surfaced in the New York Times and other media outlets. Did the Greek government use derivative contracts concocted by Wall Street banks to hide the depth of that country's budget problems? A Greek official said today those investments were legal at the time and are no longer being used. But it didn't exactly set a good tone for those Eurozone partners being asked to pony up. Marketplace's Stephen Beard joins us now from London. And Stephen, I suspect that wasn't the most cordial of meetings. Did they manage to decide anything?
Not a lot, it seems. The stalemate continues. The Greeks have been urging their fellow members of the Eurozone to spell out the rescue plan, how they're going to save Greece. But the biggest member and the richest member of the Eurozone, Germany, wants to know what Greece is doing to save itself. The Germans want hard evidence that the Greeks are cutting their deficit before they talk about bailing them out. So this meeting today hasn't satisfied either the Greeks or financial markets. We don't know if there is a set of measures that the Eurozone will take to save Greece from default.
What about this news about this supposed cooking the books, so to speak, by Greece? Did it cause the finance ministers to dig in their heels at that meeting today, do you think?
I think so, without any doubt. I mean, it has hardened particularly the German resolve not to pour large amounts of their cash into Greece. There's a pretty widespread view in Germany that Greek governments in the past have been both feckless and deceitful. And feelings are running quite high about this in Germany. The Germans say, we've made sacrifices, we've cut our public spending and, for example, raised our state retirement age to 67, while the Greek unions are now threatening to strike over the plan to raise the Greek retirement age to only 63. So the Germans say, why should we pay up so that the Greeks can retire much earlier than we can? It's a nonsense, they say.
Well, you say they didn't decide much today. Is this bound to mean more jitters for the financial markets going forward?
I think it's inevitable, especially as seems likely if the recession in Greece deepens, making it more difficult for them to service their public debt. The Greeks are in a sort of vicious circle here. They're being pressured into cutting their deficit, but cutting public spending and putting up taxes in a recession is going to make the recession worse, which will reduce tax revenue and push up public spending and increase the deficit. They probably can't win.
Now, beyond Greece, we keep hearing about other countries, Spain, Portugal, Ireland, Italy, that are still heavily indebted. Is the future of the euro in jeopardy?
It would be extraordinary if the euro collapsed, because it's not in any of the members' interest that it should. The consequence of the euro falling apart would be devastating, damaging for all member states. But it is possible. If we got a very severe double-dip recession here in Europe with even more serious budget problems, it is possible. Currency unions like this, and this is the biggest in history, do usually eventually fall apart.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. Thanks for keeping us updated.
Okay, Bob.
Cell phone makers are about to dial up the competition. The Mobile World Congress kicked off today in Barcelona. And the telecom companies from around the world are unveiling their new ideas for the half-trillion-dollar industry. More than 24 of them announced plans to create a common site for mobile phone applications. As Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith reports, they've all got one rival in their sights.
If you want to check snow conditions on the mountain, there's an app for that. If you want to check how many calories are in your lunch, There's an app for that.
There's also an app for setting your TiVo, tuning your piano, checking surf conditions, and figuring out how much to tip. The Apple Store has about 150,000 apps. More than 99% of all app sales last year went to Apple.
It's incredible how quickly it's growing. That's an enormous revenue opportunity for Apple and all the app makers.
The app market is expected to be worth nearly $7 billion this year. Telecom analyst Jeff Kagan says that's got lots of carriers and handset makers hoping to get a piece of the app action. So today, Verizon, China Mobile, Sony, and others announced they are teaming up to create an app store that could be accessed by dozens of different devices. Kagan says it's a smart move.
On their own, it would have been harder. Together, I think their chances of being successful are probably as good as Apple.
But even their combined 3 billion customers aren't going to be enough to take the app out of Apple, says Renee Ritchie, editor of TIPB, an iPhone blog.
You have 24 of the biggest telecommunications companies in the world. To get them to all agree on an open standard, and then all the devices will have to be compatible. It's going to be a bit of an uphill battle for them.
Ritchie says because Apple controls all of its content, it can make sure all of its apps are user-friendly, something that will be harder for a diverse group of companies. I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
Wall Street was off in a good way today. We'll check the markets overseas when we do the numbers. We opened with those ongoing money woes in Greece. Some financial analysts over there actually point to the super expensive Summer Olympics in Athens as a big contributor to all that red ink. It always seems to come as a huge surprise to politicians that being a host city can be a burden of Olympic proportions. This year, protesters in Vancouver have been focusing on billions of dollars that they say should have been spent on more important things. Vaughn Palmer is a columnist for the Vancouver Sun, and he's been looking back to a time when the public price tag seemed oh so puny before it started creeping higher and higher. Vaughn, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me on, Bob.
Take me back to the beginning when the Vancouver organizers are launching this bid to host the Winter Olympics. What was supposed to be the cost at the time?
At the time, they were talking about staging the entire games for less than $1 billion. Most of the money was going to come from sponsorship, television revenue, private sector investors. And at most, they figured they needed about $100 million from two levels of government, our senior government in Canada and the government of British Columbia.
Okay, so that was back in December of 1997, and then we have officials saying, hey, the games are going to pay for themselves, we just have to make sure there's a good business plan and we're not subsidizing this. And then we come to this kind of secretive thing about the city of Vancouver having to take over the risk in completing the athletes' village?
Look, this is a standard pattern with Olympics. When they start bidding, they lowball what it's going to cost the taxpayers. You mentioned the Olympic Village in the city of Vancouver. The company that was building it got into financial trouble. The city had to step in and bail it out. They had no choice. Normally, when a building project, like a residential project, is in financial trouble in a recession, well, it gets mothballed. They couldn't mothball the Olympic Village. They needed it to house the athletes starting this last month.
But according to the Vancouver Organizing Committee, even today, the official operating budget is $1.65 billion, total venue construction cost of $542 million. That doesn't sound too bad to me.
That another key aspect of the Olympic racket. When you're talking to people who want to host the Games, they only talk about the cost of staging the Games, which means the actual events and any venues. They do not include in that price tag security, all the other things you need to do in order to get the International Olympic Committee to award the games to you.
Okay, by your reckoning, what is the cost going to be?
I figure around $8 billion. I mean, it's approaching that. That's all in, and look, some of that will be recovered from television rights, ticketing, sponsorships. And we will have some things left over. We had to rebuild a major highway here in British Columbia to get the games. Well, the highway will be usable for many years to come.
What's your read on the public mood in Vancouver? Do people think it's been worth it?
I would say the most recent opinion polls suggest that Canadians in general feel great about the games. They feel really positive about them. That feeling is more mixed in British Columbia. And I think the reason it is more mixed in the opinion polls in British Columbia is twofold. One, the games are now a massive disruption to a society because of security and all that. The other reason is I think British Columbians are acutely aware of a lot of the cost issues. They expect to go on paying for these games for some years to come.
Vaughn Palmer is a columnist with the Vancouver Sun. Thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome. It was fun.
Given it's a holiday, perhaps you're thinking about spending a few of your Washingtons and Lincolns on going out somewhere to eat tonight. Across much of the country, you'll find better options for dining out than you did a couple of decades ago. Cleveland is no exception, despite that city's problems with foreclosures and poverty. From WCPN, Dan Bobkoff tells us why new restaurants keep opening and succeeding.
I didn't expect much from Cleveland's restaurants when I moved here 3 years ago. I had an East Coast snob's opinion of Midwestern cooking. Boy, was I wrong. What are you thinking of ordering?
I could order anything on this menu and be happy.
I'm at lunch with food writer and Cleveland food booster Michael Ruhlman. We're sitting in a new restaurant called L'Albatro. It's an old carriage house with bold artwork on the brick walls. Our waiter comes over to help us decipher the appetizer.
It's a braised tongue and oxtail terrine with pickled mustard seeds. Next to it is kind of a roulade of sorts, pork with dried figs.
I think there was some rabbit in there, too. Foodies, take note. Here in the Rust Belt, you can now get a world-class meal for about what you'd pay at an Olive Garden.
Can you believe that? Duck confit, pork belly, two different kinds of sausages, and some great white beans for $14. You cannot beat that.
This restaurant opened up just last year at the height of the financial crisis. Yet owner and chef Zach Brule says L'Albatro is thriving. Cleveland's low cost of living means those with jobs can generally afford some nice meals. And he says there's a demand now for interesting food.
The sophistication level has changed dramatically in the last 25 years. I mean, if I would never have thought of doing this concept 25 years ago.
In the next few weeks, Brule will open his fourth new restaurant in 5 years. And he has competition like never before. From chefs like Dante Bucuzzi, who's putting the finishing touches on two new restaurants in Cleveland's up-and-coming Tremont neighborhood. It's gentrification just blocks from once bustling steel mills.
Soft benches, some nice coffee tables.
Bucuzzi made his name in big cities like New York, where the pace is fast and failure is common. Cleveland's cheap rent and lower startup costs make opening here a less risky bet.
Everything about it is a lot less, and I think that was one of the main draws that brought me back to Cleveland. Just the whole market itself. I mean, there's a lot of great restaurants, but it's not like there's 3,000 of them like New York City.
But 20 years ago, chefs like Bucuzzi likely wouldn't have had much luck in smaller cities. What changed? Americans got a lot more food savvy. They started to ask what's in their meals and where the ingredients came from. Organic and local food entered the lexicon. Enrollment went way up at U.S. culinary schools. And let's not forget the rise of the Food Network.
The next Iron Chef is Chef Simon!
Michael Simon, Cleveland's hottest chef, put his city on the culinary map when he won the Food Network's Iron Chef competition 2 years ago.
He was definitely, has become the poster child for Cleveland, and every city needs a poster child.
Andrew Knowlton is the restaurant editor for Bon Appetit magazine. He and Cleveland food writer Michael Ruhlman were both judges on that show. Knowlton says the burgeoning foodie scene in Cleveland is a microcosm for what's happening nationwide, and that the availability of great ingredients from local farms gives the Midwest an edge.
You know, the food revolution is going to happen in the flyover states. It's not about New York and San Francisco.
Then maybe I'm not a snob. Good food is now mainstream. So, in Cleveland, where the food's great, I'm Dan Bobkoff for Marketplace.
suddenly hungry. Coming up, the song factories of Tin Pan Alley.
It's based on ideas of division of labor, of economies of scale. And they were very successful at promoting a new kind of popular music.
But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street took the day off, and it was a holiday in China, too. Although I don't think they observe President's Day there. Anyway, it was a winning day on major European stock exchanges. Britain's FTSE, Germany's DAX, and France's CAC 40 all closed up between 0.25% and 0.5%. Analysts say it might have been even better had it not been for the lack of clarity over financial support for Greece. British Airways rose more than 2.5% after news that U.S. authorities have tentatively allowed American Airlines and its four One World Alliance partners antitrust immunity on transatlantic routes. Japan's Nikkei lost 0.8%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term goals. 1-888-VANGUARD. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet. Throughout the trading day, we're talking business and the economy on our blog, The Scratchpad. Check in with online host Scott Jagow and join the discussion at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at the events for Tuesday. In Brussels, European finance ministers are scheduled to meet and discuss the EU's fiscal crisis. Former White House officials and private technology companies plan to demonstrate what a mock cyber attack on the United States would look like. And Tuesday marks the fifth-year anniversary for the Kyoto Protocol, the massive international treaty that aimed to reduce global carbon emissions. I'm Kevin Ferguson.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Rizdahl. It is possible in this day and age to stay in touch 24 hours a day, if you so choose. As we heard at the top of the program, there's undoubtedly an app for that. But suppose you'd rather not. Is there an app to make it all go away? iPhones and Blackberries and laptops have made it almost impossible to disconnect. Try as we might, it's just hard to ignore all those emails and text messages and phone calls. So it's no wonder a lot of us are overwhelmed. Sally Herships may have an answer.
Every night, my boyfriend brings his iPhone to bed and his BlackBerry. Did I mention the laptop?
It's 5:45, and my boyfriend's phone just rang.
It was somebody from work.
And you answered it?
I did.
This, to put it mildly, doesn't make me happy. I'm trying not to take it personally. My boyfriend is a journalist and a news junkie. And it's not like he needs an excuse to stay wired all the time. Connected is the new normal. That drives Jenny Rausch nuts. Rausch is a journalism professor in New York, and she's what you might call old school.
I've tried telling my friends, I don't text. I don't have a text plan. Every time you send me a text message, it costs me 15 cents.
It's not the money that gets Rausch. It's the expectations. She says people who are totally wired expect everyone else to be, too. Rausch doesn't want to feel pressured to answer emails on Saturdays. She wants her time back.
Something has to go, and the thing that has to go is the digital media.
Rausch is planning to go all the way. Next year, she'll set the clock back to 1985.
There will be television.
But no DVR.
A landline.
But no cell phones.
Records.
There's a movement for people like Rausch. It's called slow media. Kind of like slow food, but without the food. Slowies write letters and, you know, talk to each other, offline. They like to do one thing at a time. Nick Jones is a computer programmer who lives in North Carolina. He has a slow media group on Facebook. Jones gets the irony, but he knows the downside of multitasking.
Sometimes I would have the British office. It would be like on mute and running, and then there's a song playing, and then there's me writing code. And it was just, you know, it was too much. It was like trying to drink from a fire hose. It just wasn't, it didn't work. Thanks, high-speed internet.
But what does work, especially at work? Can you really get away with slowing down? Tom Jackson, also known as Dr. Email, teaches information science in England. He says technology isn't the problem. It's the way we use it.
The majority of employees react to incoming email within 6 seconds. Now, most people have their email application set up to check for new email every 5 minutes.
Jackson says every time you're distracted by an email, it takes about a minute to get back to what you were doing. All that time adds up. The average employee spends almost 800 hours a year just reading email. That's not including recovery time. Eric Bradlow is a professor of interactive media at Wharton. He says even if we took technology away, we'd still have a problem.
So I'll go back to the old days. I'll walk around to the water cooler and I'll sit there chatting with people. I think people will replace one form of distraction with another.
Bradlow says certain types of people, like him and my boyfriend, want to be connected 24/7. And that can be a good thing for employers. Bradlow says people who spend a lot of time in social media tend to be high achievers. And Jenny Rausch, the journalism professor, and Nick Jones, the computer programmer, do want to stay connected. They're both blogging about their new approach to media, slowly. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
We talk a lot about the current state of the music industry, how iTunes is replacing compact discs, and bands are turning to the internet to market music instead of record companies. Well, today we're going back, I mean way back, to the beginnings of popular music in America. In David Sussman's book, Selling Sounds, he explains how music makers turned a profit and made songs popular before there even was radio, like this turn-of-the-century tune.
After the ball is over, after the parade's born, after the dancers leaving, after the stars are gone.
David, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Tell me about this song. How did it become a hit in the 1890s before there was even radio?
Well, this is one of the songs that really opened the door for the music business as we know it today. It was made a big hit basically through really heavy promotion. It was written by a man named Charles K. Harris, who devised a new style of song that was particularly easy to sing, was very, very catchy, and he promoted it coast to coast, particularly by paying performers to include it in their stage shows.
What got you interested in this type of music, in this period of music?
Well, I actually wasn't really interested in this type of music. I was interested in trying to understand something about the musical world that I live in today, and I was sort of setting out to understand how it is that we have so much music around us, and that music is so intricately connected to the music industry. So I'll give you one example. The song Happy Birthday to You, a song that's very easy to imagine belongs to all of us, or maybe to none of us, is actually a copyrighted work, and it belongs to the Warner Music Group, which was rather surprising to me.
When did this idea of a music, quote-unquote, industry even start, the idea that music went beyond just simple creation?
It's very much a creation of the 1870s, 80s, and 90s, when this new generation of young music publishers started making music along a model that was not that different from industrial manufacturing. It was based on ideas of division of labor, of economies of scale. And they were very successful at promoting a new kind of popular music, so much so that by 1910, the New York Times was referring to the so-called song factories of Tin Pan Alley.
Speaking of Tin Pan Alley, you spend a lot of time in the book on some of the publishers of that era who were really colorful, it seems.
Yeah. I mean, one of the pleasures of working on this book was I got to deal with some great characters. So one of the stories that I begin the book with is the story of one of the most influential Tin Pan Alley music publishing firms, the firm called M. Whitmark & Sons, which was started by three young boys. The eldest of them was 14 years old, and he started this firm in the 1880s with his younger brothers, aged 13 and 11. And they went on to build one of the most successful and most influential songwriting and music publishing firms in New York, which is to say in the whole country.
The first teeny bop music stars, huh?
Yeah, yeah.
I'd like to play a piece of music from another early music pioneer. This one's from Irving Berlin, Alexander's Ragtime Band.
Come on here, come on here, Alexander's Ragtime Band. Come on here, come on in here, it's the best band in the land.
Now, Irving Berlin was really instrumental in creating the modern notion of a popular song. You write that he came up with sort of a tip sheet on what makes a songwriter successful.
Yeah, by the late teens and 20s, he was very well known, especially for this song, which was a landmark hit for him. And by the late 19-teens and 20s, he was so well known for this that people turned to him and wanted to know, well, how do you do it? And he came up with a list of 9 recommended guidelines to follow for writing an enormously successful song. And it included some real common sense things like the musical range of the song must be accessible to somebody with an average voice. You can't write it for a virtuoso singer. He said also you should do things like have a title that is repeated over and over in the song so that they can go and then buy it.
I think today they call that the hook, huh?
Yeah, well, it's the lyrical hook. The musical hook had to be there, too. And then he also emphasized that this is a business. And this is another one of his things. Is that if you want to have a hit song, you need to understand this isn't about passion or art or genius or magic. It's about figuring out how to succeed in a business way.
And are our notions of popular music even today informed by the Tin Pan Alley era?
Oh, very much. I think a lot of the assumptions that we have about what a popular song is are still in place from 100 years ago. The genres have changed, to be sure, but the idea that a pop song is something that lasts about 3.5-4 minutes, it has some verses that are relatively unimportant and a chorus that is the really important part and is very catchy, those are assumptions that are very specific to this model of music making that Tin Pan Alley developed and promoted very, very successfully.
David Sussman's book is Selling Sounds, The Commercial Revolution in American Music. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. And by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note, remember that old slogan, you asked for it, you got it, Toyota? Well, as they say on those car ads, there's never been a better time to ask for it at a Toyota dealer near you. An executive says Toyota may double incentives and or lengthen warranties to lure in customers. Toyota VP Bob Carter spoke to the big national car dealers convention in Orlando, Florida. He says mechanics are almost a quarter of the way through repairing the 2 million-plus models recalled for sticky gas pedals. And here's a point he made that he'd probably like you to know most of all. If you think Toyota dealers have stopped selling cars, that's a mistaken impression. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. The U.S. markets were closed today for the President's Day holiday. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Eng. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Next time on our program, Haitians in the U.S. shoulder the burden of rebuilding.
Normally, you send money to loved ones, to immediate family. But now they find themselves being solicited by people they're not related to.
I'm Bob Moon. Hope you can join Kai for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.